Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the Grayscale Gorilla podcast. It's Nick Campbell here. I feel like I don't ever say my name, although I feel like I say my name too much. So I don't know. I don't know the rules. Let's talk about you guys. We also have Chris Schmidt here. Good to see you, buddy.
Good morning, everybody.
And as always, Chad Ashley. How are you, good sir?
I'm doing well. How are everyone?
How are everyone? Oh, I are good. You are?
Me speak English well.
You are nice. Happy Tuesday. We're off a day this week. That's okay. It was a big week last week. We had a lot to kind of fit in to everything. So we're back. We what's been going on, man?
We survived.
We made it through the week, you know. For us behind the scenes, I know we talk a little bit about behind the scenes at Grayscale Gorilla. I hope when it helps you guys. We're also, like many of you, running a business and trying to hit deadlines and figure all this stuff out. And last week we launched Gorilla Guide to X Particles, which if you haven't checked that out, or last week's podcast, we talked with John Bosley, who helped us make Gorilla Guide to X Particles.
So really like that one. That
was a good episode. Oh, it was an awesome episode. It's good to learn more about John. And we also launched the Happy Toolbox model pack, which is a little different for us. It's the first model pack we've sold on the site. But if you do, a lot of explainer videos, if you do a lot of animations where you need, you know, a nice, well designed models for the background. Check it out, because it's a little hard to describe. I'm not even doing a great job at it.
But I bet Chad's got the
when we saw it. Yeah, well, when I think it's one of those things when you see it, you're like, why doesn't this exist?
Yeah, that's actually how it happened when I showed it to you. So I'm a big fan of the Happy Toolbox, and I love their style. And so when this was kind of presented to me, I was like, oh my God, these are amazing. All of these models in one sort of contained, really creative, whimsical style. And I think I was chatting with Nick at the time while I was looking at them, and I just sent him some screenshots. And Nick was like, it was like the equivalent of love at first sight, I think, with you. Like, you literally were like, oh my God, these are the best things ever.
Well, what happens is if you're buying models, you go search, and there's plenty of models that are photo real and that have all the detail and that are trying to look like what they're trying to make, right? So, you know, if I want a DeLorean from Back to the Future, I could go find it, and it's got all the details and all the little lighting around it. And then if I want a tree, I can go get like a photo real looking tree. But then when I want it to be more stylized, or I want it to be more like minimal, or I want it to be set dressing and not like a super photoreal centerpiece, I feel like that's when it falls apart for me. That's when it's hard to find a consistently looking style that where all the pieces fit together. And as soon as you see this model pack, you're like, oh, wow, there's like 180, 190 models that all look that all feel like they're carved by the same artist, that all feel like they're part of a world. And that's
the thing for me. The world thing is, I think, really what kind of sold me on it is that, like you said, if you are doing some sort of stylized non-photoreal animation and you don't have time to model a donut, and you go to a website and you start looking around for donut models, you might find a donut model, but then it won't match the
hamburger.
The hamburger, the whatever else, you know, in this crazy video that you're making. So you end up with this like collaged hodgepodge of stuff. And if you're just doing a pitch or just sort of working on something quickly and you don't have time to hire an art director to design it and a modeler to model it or do it all yourself, that's where this sort of product, I think, really comes in handy, where you can, you know, everything's going to fit. It's like if you went and you bought a set of toys and it's all from the same maker and the same kit. I think that's really what makes it awesome.
That's a good way to put it. It's like they're all from the same toy manufacturer. Because you know it does. Sometimes you put the train on the wrong tracks. I've done this with my nephew, and it doesn't fit. Doesn't fit. Doesn't look right. The scale's off. And now who's having fun?
Nobody. You can't put the train on the Hot Wheels track.
That's true. Right. That's right. Thomas, here's the thing. Here's the metaphor, guys. Thomas will not fit on the Hot Wheels track. we got to the weird analogy early.
Hot Wheels tracks. How many times has that been mentioned on the? I feel like we mentioned Hot Wheels tracks before.
I think Hot Wheels tracks, that orange piece of track, is one of the like pinnacle parts of my childhood that is just lodged into everything that I do. I think everything I do is tied to either marble races, Hot Wheels tracks, domino rally, and maybe there's one other toy in there, probably video games.
Like, did you have the Domino's track where you could like have it go up your wall?
Oh, Domino's up the wall or the Hot Wheels track.
Yeah. Remember those? Like you could like, I don't remember quite how they worked, but you could like have them climb up walls and stuff.
Yeah, I had the Hot Wheels track and also I had the slot car track that did the wall stuff because those were magnetized.
Oh, slot cars, man. Those are so fun.
So that we had the slot car. I remember there was a train that went up the wall too. It's called Turbo Train. That's what it's called. That thing was awesome.
Turbo Train. I'm not sure I would have gotten into that one.
That's early 90s awesomeness. It was like glow in the dark, magnetic slot car style train set. That was like super fast, futuristic train.
Was the goal to like get the commuters to work faster, deliver the grain faster?
All right, I'm looking this up. I'm going to put this in show notes. Because, yes. Oh my gosh.
It's a thing.
It is a thing. It says 80s. It felt like it was like 80 or not early 90s to me, but all that stuff blends together in a whirl of hypercolor and neon to me. So I'm going to put this in the show notes. You want to learn about some Turbo Train. As always, if you're listening, I forgot to mention this last week. We have show notes on every podcast. Anything we talk about, we try to put a link there either in YouTube. If you're watching us on YouTube, you can look down below, or if you're listening through iTunes or anywhere else, we also have notes. It should be in the app if you check on the podcast app, or you could just go to our website to this latest one. You can find it at the blog and click and learn about Turbo Train.
Hot Wheels tracks always ended up, every time I pull them out with my friends, it ended up in a fight where Hot Wheels tracks were wielded as weapons.
And it
was always so painful. Like, who could withstand the hardest hit of a Hot Wheels track?
This was like a belt at that point.
Yeah, I mean, if you've been hit with one, it hurts bad. So you would like hit your friend and then say, okay, I bet I can take it hard. And bam, you know.
Back and forth.
Maybe it was just me. Maybe Chris,
There was a good, 3 months at Grayscale Gorilla got obsessed with the Hot Wheels tracks. And we made rigs and animations and dynamic cars that fell apart. And the cars were fighting each other. And we were building simple AI algorithms in the cars so they could intelligently back up if they got stuck and whatnot.
Yeah, I gotta put those in the show notes as well. Those were fun. We did if you've been to Half Res and you've seen the cube races, we did something similar with the Hot Wheels. Remember, we did like, we didn't know who would win.
Yes.
And then we would broadcast the live races. And in this case, they weren't races, they were just cars that would like crash into each other over and over again, and then the last one on the track would win. And every time you refreshed it, a new car would win. And we would like sit on live shows and take bets. Who's winning? Pink?
Man, I feel like there's a whole industry there waiting to happen.
I tell you, it was Twitch before Twitch, you know, like everyone watching us crash Hot Wheels cars in Cinema 40 through Ustream. That's a lot of names there. Oh my gosh. Happy Toolbox model pack.
It's out. You can go check it out on our website. What's your favorite model? Everybody pick their favorite model from the pack.
Oh,
I already have mine.
I go to the Bob, and maybe we should not use that name for copyright reasons, but it's a cartoonized bomb with a fuse on the top, a la 80s video games that are still popular. I don't want to use the N word.
Yeah, I was really hoping we wouldn't have to edit that. Chris, what's your favorite?
Well, I mean, I just love how all of them go together. But if I had to pick one, I really like the fish, like the food fish, where it's all dead and chopped up and this cartoony thing. It's
that
it's
sounds like really good to those people who haven't seen it yet.
Oh yeah, I guess I'm not making it sound right. But the point being is, it's one of those things where in your head you picture the essence of this idea. Where in cartoons there's always like that, the fish on the plate that was supposed to seem unappealing. And this is so perfectly that I couldn't have put that together if I wanted to, just because it's so perfectly the essence of that thing. I love it.
Wow.
Chad.
I like the hamburger.
Hamburger's good.
Hamburger is just funny. I don't know why. I just like it. It just reminds me of those big, I don't know if you remember those big signs where there'd just be a burger as the giant sign made out of plexiglass or fiberglass or whatever, but it just reminds me of one of those.
Yeah, I'm glad we talked about it. Definitely check it out. It's one of those things where you look at it, you're like, when I need it, I'm definitely going to grab it. And it's not like you got to, you know, go grab it today, although it is on sale for the next week. So we're having a launch price on the Gorilla Guide to X Particles and the Happy Toolbox model pack. And that all ends Tuesday, October 24th. Did I get that right?
Yep. I think, is it a Tuesday? I believe it is.
Yeah. Yes. So to celebrate the launch and to get the word out about both of these things, we're having, we have a launch price for both of them. And they both go back to full price on Tuesdays. So October 24th. Definitely check it out if you're looking at, if you use X Particles, definitely check out X Particles training. Gorilla Guide. All right. You know what? What's our big topic today? Because we've been trying to figure out some of the bigger topics. Talk about, we always talk about software when it comes up. We talk about, new rendering stuff. Maybe we should get a little update for the render wars. But one of the goals, at least in my mind, one of our goals here at the podcast is talk about some of the things that aren't as intuitive and aren't things that you would have as a class in school. How to talk to clients and how to stay productive and how to be creative and those kind of things. So I like when we get to the topics for sure. In fact, last week I just jumped right in. That was bad. Anyway, I'm talking in circles. Real quick, Chad, do you have any Render Wars update news? Because it's been at least a couple weeks.
There's probably a lot more, but I'll keep it short. The thing that I really liked that happened in the last couple weeks is that Arnold finally got Cinema 4D noises, which is huge. Everybody that uses any sort of third-party renderer knows that they can't use Cinema 4D's noises natively. There's some that do it by baking it down at render time, which is kind of jacked up because it's not really got seams and it's just not procedural. Well, this is actual Cinema 4D noises, the Nakis, the hit me, Chris, give me some more.
Luca, Boya.
Luca, there you go. Booyah. Booyah is there.
Voronoi.
And they're all there. They're not no fakery. They're really there as true procedurals in object and world space. And it's awesome to have those in a third party renderer. So good job, Arnold people.
Nice work. I like noises. I like Naki.
Don't knock the Naki.
Dude, noises are so amazing. I've talked about them before. I think noises are the greatest thing ever. But even if you're using a photo texture, one of my favorite things is if you have a tiling photo texture and you can overlay a noise, even just a purlin noise, overlay it at like a 25% opacity, you will break up the patterns on the larger scale. And that's what you need it to do, because that's when it starts tiling, your eye is going to be drawn to a specific detail. But if you have a large-ish overlay or even a medium detail overlay, your eye is going to be drawn to that larger pattern and not the smaller tiling pattern.
Yeah, pro tip.
That's actually used a lot, not necessarily procedural noises, but that idea is used a lot in video game texturing, where you want to have at least like three levels of detail or three scales so that a tile isn't necessarily as visible, because there's obviously a lot of tiling in video game textures. And the way they get around that is that they try to make it, to try to hide it in different scales. And that's what, yeah, I agree. Obviously, it's another tip on that front too, is to have several noises of different scales kind of overlaying your textures so that it's not even, you can even break it up one step further. But yeah, I haven't been able to use Cinema 4D's noises pretty much since I started. I think I started using Cinema 4D, played around with physical and I was using them. But as soon as I got into third-party rendering, I was like, well, I just got to use whatever noises they have. And usually they all only have like one or two. So this is pretty big for me to be able to like jump in and use a lot of the noises that I've seen Chris use over the years. And it's just kind of fun to throw those onto a displacement and see what awesome stuff you get.
Yo.
Anyway.
Get them noises. Get them noises.
Yep.
And that reminds me, we are currently updating our live show. So if you are looking for stuff from Redshift, I know Chad has some future Redshift coming up, and some Arnold stuff too. And it'll all be live, or you'll get the schedule at grayscalegorilla.com/live. We're really trying to keep that page up and current, and we have live show scheduled through December now. So head there and learn about some of the live shows we have coming up and try to show up live so you can ask some questions. If you've always wanted to ask some questions about Redshift or Arnold or Chris and I also have some Cinema 4D, you know, animation stuff, some lighting stuff coming up. So
I have a show coming up tomorrow on Wednesday about breaking glass.
Oh, yeah. Dude, that'd be fun. Get that.
Also, a good idea for people is to go to our, I get this a lot. We do these Twitch streams and then people want to watch them on YouTube. Go to our YouTube channel and click on the little thing that looks like a bell. And every time we post a video, you'll get a notification on your phone or tablet or wherever you are so that you can watch it right away if you want.
Yeah, I forget they do that now. You got to ring that bell. Yeah, mm-hmm. if you want to get notifications, that's true on, I think, Instagram too. There's ways anywhere. Anybody you want to like get the watch the thing the day it comes out. Yeah, go turn that on. Watch some videos. Well, let's get into the main topic today. And I think Chad, you wanna set this one up?
Yeah, I'll set it up. So today's topic kind of came around an instant message a friend of mine sent me yesterday. They said, you know, oh my God, Chad, I need your help. I've got a client that wants to check in with me every day on this 3D project, and that's just way too much. I can't get anything done because I'm constantly worried about having to update them and bring them up to speed. And how do I manage this? How do I manage this client? And so that kind of like, we talked about it before the show, and we thought this would be a great topic to talk about how to manage your client's expectations. What are some techniques that we've done and we've seen other people successfully employ to manage clients' expectations, not isolate them, make them feel part of the process, but also give you enough room to do what you need to do. And it's really hard. It's actually a really hard thing to learn because it's one of those skills that nobody really invites you in to tell you about it. And if you're at a studio, you usually just kind of learn as you go. And if you're working on your own, like let's say you have your own clients and you're dealing with this sort of thing, you don't have anybody to turn to because you're your own company or maybe you just work remotely. That's a really hard thing to navigate. And every client is different. Expectations are different. But yeah, I thought we could discuss that and maybe talk about some of our techniques that we use.
Yeah, as always, you know, Chad, you've had like probably the most client experience from all of us. And what do you think the main thing is to keep in mind when you're, let's talk about it through a freelancer, but also through a company, because I think there's slightly different ways to tackle it. But let's say you're a freelancer out there and you're trying to set expectations with your client. What are some of the main things that you could do either through verbally over the phone or through email or in a contract to really start to set up these expectations?
I mean, ultimately, the contract is the best way to do it, because it's not only setting expectations, but it's also protecting you and everything. But let's all be honest, like, that is not always going to happen. Like, you're not always going to have time to set up a contract. And like, sometimes clients can be like, contracts, lawyers, like, I just need this logo to spin around. Like, what's your, this is way too difficult. But I think it's really good to just, what I told my friend was like, well, it all starts at the beginning. You should have had this conversation day one and build a calendar together. And that's usually the best way to kind of set expectations, is if you build out a calendar and not just like, we're going to start here on this date and we're going to end here on this date. That's not a calendar. Those are just deadlines. And so that's not how you do that. You have to make them feel like they're part of the process. You have to say, okay, during this first week, we're going to be roughing this out, and let's choose, like, and it's up to you, like, how many check-ins do you think you'll need with the client to make them happy and be able to get your work done? So let's just say three. So you schedule out three different check-ins and you make it really clear what you're going to be checking in on. So that way they feel like they understand the progress of the project, and you also give yourself, because you're the one controlling that, you can decide when you feel comfortable showing what part of the project. But it's hard to do that, because it's sometimes things happen. And I mean, really, the question is, when you have a client that just doesn't get that, you can lay that out all you want. But if you have a client that either, number one, just wants to be more involved, or doesn't understand or respect the process, what are some strategies you guys think you can employ to help that out?
I think, money's always a good way to show people, like, yeah, yes, you could do whatever you want, but, and here's what it costs, is my go-to way. When I was dealing with client stuff, when I was trying to price myself, when I was trying to let them know, like, there are three times that we show, you know, there are three check-ins, and this is how it goes. I'm going to show you the gray version, and then I'm going to show you the textured version, and then I'm going to show you the final version, and maybe one more thing after that. Maybe it's three or four. You spell that out. And then if there's more stuff other than the standard way of doing it, the answer that I've always tried to build into, or the answer I've seen work the best, is the yes, of course, and answer, which is, of course, yeah, we could work closer together. You know, that's going to slow it down a little bit, but it's also going to, like, take more time. So here's what that costs, and then start to a la carte build those types of things into your contract or into your agreement, because the answer, because you're going to let them know that this costs time and money, and that's really what they're paying you for. So you could say, yeah, sure, absolutely, we could do triple the amount of check-ins. Here's what it costs. It's going to be 50% more, because look at all the extra time we have to review, we have to meet up, I have to render it and post it. Like, this is a lot of extra work, but of course I could do that for you. You're the best. And so you just spell it out and you put it in there, and the odds are is they're going to go, oh, well, maybe we just do six instead of 20. And you go, awesome, that's a great idea. You're the smartest. You're the smartest client. And then go from there. I don't, is that,
yeah, I mean, nothing will squash requests like an honest, like telling them it's going to cost money. And I think that's a surefire way to see exactly how serious they are about a tweak, a change, a scope creep, is you put a dollar amount in front of them, and the answer, like you said, always, and I think we've said this on the podcast before, the answer is always yes. But and if you do that, and you make them decide with their dollars, and because of course anybody's going to want everything they can get, the best of everything that they can get for nothing, if they can get it.
They want everything for nothing. That's right. What they want.
So that's totally fine. I mean, we all are like that. We all want the most channels, the most whatever, the most data, you know, all the unlimited in our world. But as soon as you like say yes, but that's going to cost you this, it really, it forces the client to say, ooh, well, does this making this one element green instead of blue, is that really going to impact the overall storytelling or the impact of the goal of this piece? Is it worth the $500 or whatever it is going to be to change it? And it, and it's great because it's not you telling them no. It's not you telling them that it's a bad idea. It's not you telling them that it's just not going to impact their goal, even though you might think that it will. It makes them decide that. And then you're not the bad guy. You're not the bad artist. So that's kind of a good way to handle it. But here's another curveball I'll throw at you guys. What would you do if you were doing a job and the client not only like wanted frequent check-ins, but wanted to come sit behind you while you are lighting a shot?
Oh man, that is a tough one.
Didn't have a producer to talk him out of it.
So that's have you ever had that happen, Chris? Because that could be very frustrating. You ever had a client walk in and watch you make changes? I guess that's no. I don't know if you did.
I was just about to type into the message for you guys. My internet's going terrible. I'm getting listening to Meg.
This is the part of the show where Chris's audio stuff messes
it's,
up.
It's not that. I didn't accidentally hit my microphone this time. Now, yeah. My Comcast internet is giving me less than a meg.
Well, I'll say my piece for this one, and then if you're doing better, Chris, I'll re-ask the question, because I think this is one of those really frustrating moments for me when I did more client work. One of the hardest things to do was to do what I needed to do with a client behind me. It was very frustrating. And some people can work this way, and some people kind of enjoy the company and the camaraderie, and they're kind of like entertaining the client. And they're also getting work done. And I think some people are built for this, but my personality was very much like, I'm going to sit here and mess up 100 times before I get to the good part. And if all you do is correct the 100 mistakes, we'll never get to the good part, because that's kind of how I worked. I was like, that doesn't look good. That doesn't look good. Let me tweak it here. Let me move the camera angle here. Let me make that's my creative process. And if my brain already has somebody sitting behind it saying, not yet, not yet, not yet. Yeah. Okay. Now that's looking better. And if you also have a real person behind you, that's a maddening situation. So for me, it was hard. I don't know what I would actually do. What I would probably do is have them in close by, and I would try to say, I would tell them exactly this. Like, when I work, I already have my own internal creative director yelling at me to try to make it as good as possible for you. And so the best way that this is going to work is to have you close by so that we could get this done quickly. But let me set you up with like your favorite Xbox game so that you can like, you know, sit here and hang out and I could get some work done, and then we'll meet up very, very like often, and then we'll get, you know, quick changes happening.
I'm back up to fast again. I don't know what's up, but I don't think I've ever been in that situation where it was a kind of an open-ended creative thing. When I was doing scenic stuff, we had kind of a set library of things, and a bunch of custom things didn't happen very often. So I could have one of our project directors come in and sit behind me occasionally. It didn't happen often, but they could sit there, and I could, because of the tools I had built myself, I could do this in real time. But I don't think that's something that's not a situation where a lot of people could be like, okay, we're placing these on stage. Okay, you're done. I'm going to do the lighting, but like, we've got it all figured out. But yeah, I don't think I would. Having someone sit behind you and watch you can be one of the worst things, especially if there's any semblance of you're doing something creative, it is gone when somebody's sitting behind you.
Yeah, I think that's that. I just don't think there's some things that I consider to be session based and that are better in a session, because you need, in order for the job to move quickly, you need the client's eyes on it almost continuously. Things like color, things like finish, some compositing. Like that type of thing where it makes a lot of sense to have them there the whole time editing. I'm talking specifically about advertising and entertainment work and, you know, other sort of industrial stuff too, I guess. It's why people, why clients sit in on the editorial session is because they need to be able to make decisions very quickly. If that process were strung out, meaning the editor did a cut, sent it to the client, got feedback, did another cut, that process would take months to do. Now, it makes sense there. It doesn't, in my opinion, make sense in 3D because 3D is not necessarily one of those things that needs a decision every 2 seconds from the client. I think you can, I like Nick's answer where it can happen and we can be in the same building and we can even be in the same room. But if you're sitting right here looking at my screen, that is actually slowing me down because I'm unable to experiment and go through my process like Nick was saying, because now I've got this filter of another pair of eyeballs to worry about. But if you're right behind me and you're on that Xbox that you mentioned, then I can like, oh, let me get this. Oh, I think this looks pretty cool. Let me see what the client thinks. Hey, client, good, bad, yes, no, more blue, bigger. Okay, cool. And then, okay, give me 5 minutes, blah, 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 and do that. Like, I think that's okay. But I would prefer always to not do it at all and just say, well, what is your worry here? Like, what is the client's motivated to do that? The client's motivation is what you really need to get to. If they're saying, I want to sit in with you while you're lighting this, then you have to say to yourself, well, is it because they just want to get out of the office? Is it because they don't trust me? Is it because they have a very specific thing and they don't know how to communicate it? Like, what is the real reason? And that's your job or producer's job to get to the bottom of what it is that they're trying to achieve by doing that. And it usually, if you find out that reason, there's a better way to solve it that makes everybody happy.
Yeah. Even just thinking about the topic in a big way and saying, okay, client expectations, what is their expectation? You kind of nailed it, though we didn't really talk about yet, which is what baggage is the wrong word, but what expectations are they bringing in that you don't know about? Maybe they think the 3D process or the animation process is totally different, or maybe they worked with other people where they did sit in the room all day. So not knowing that and being able to navigate that is tricky, but one solution or one way to think about it is to have your standard way. Set up your ideal, perfect way that where you get to do your best work, where you get feedback the way that you want to, the way that you've seen best in the past. Keep their needs in mind. Like, don't just have one video at the end that you send them. Like, have some sort of client way to talk to the client. Give them time in your process to give feedback and really set up your ideal situation based on all the knowledge that you've collected through your career and present that as a solution to start with. Because then they could look at it and go, oh, well, I'm used to being in the room. And you go, oh, I've never worked that way because of these reasons. But, you know, I totally understand. Can you tell me why you want to be here? And now you're getting to some of the questions that Chad's asking. You know, what are your worries? Do you just want to play Xbox, or do you not trust me? Getting to those questions early on can be super helpful because then you can talk directly to those things and say, hey, I'm going to send you something at the end of every day. And so maybe this is something for your friend that's asking, you know, I don't tend to have big meetings every day, but here's something I could do. Let me send you what I have. As long as you understand what gray renders look like and that you know that it's not finished till the end, I'm going to send you where I am every day. And just to let you know that I'm making progress. But we still have to stick to these times to do feedback, or else this will never get done.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's a totally realistic and practical way of dealing with that. Another thing that I think is important, and it's a trick that I learned in all the years that I've been doing this, is to, when you send that thing at the end of the day to get feedback or just to keep them up to date, here's a tip: caveat the shit out of it. And what do I mean by that? I mean, I want you to, when you're sending the animation test or a render or a design, whatever it is that you're sending to your client, I want, before you put it in that email or throw it up on Dropbox, whatever, look at it with the most critical eyes you can. And I want you to write down every single thing that you want to do to it. I still plan on tweaking this. I still want to get this right. I don't feel like I'm hitting it on this part. This color is not quite where I want it yet. And just head them off at the pass with the notes and caveat it with everything that you want to do to it. I would do this all the time with work that I would send out to the clients. And what I found 9 times out of 10, they agree and they have less notes because they see you're really putting in the extra effort to make it as awesome as you can. And you are even calling out things that maybe they didn't even catch. So you not only are creating an instant to-do list for yourself to be able to make an awesome project, but you're also making them feel better about the process because they think, wow, this person is really into this. They know, I didn't even think about making that thing red because it'll pop more and they're already going to do it on the next round. Like, that's crazy. Like, if you start doing that, you'll have less notes and you'll also have a real clear understanding of what you need to do to get the job to where you want it to be.
I have a question. And this is something, honestly, it's something that I haven't ever really had to deal with in a distinct way. And this might be helpful for a lot of people that are just getting the freelance or thinking about doing this kind of thing. Like, can we actually define, in when you say contract, what do you mean? Is this like an official written up piece of paper, or is this spelling something clearly out in an email and them agreeing to it? Like, how specific do you have to get here when you're dealing with maybe you're a freelancer and you're dealing with a client for the first time or a studio for the first time? What does contract mean?
It can mean either of those two things. It really depends on how litigious you want to get. You can, I've actually personally never even done like a real lawyer contract. It's always been an email that's just sort of a loose agreement, but those are dangerous. You can get burned with those because there's no real responsibility or accountability. That's why a lot of places and people say, you know, have a real contract ready to go, scope of work, everything laid out. And this is probably a better question for those out there that own their own studio and have had to deal with this sort of things. I always worked at a studio where producers took care of that sort of thing, or new business dev took care of it, or whatever. So I was sort of protected from that nitty gritty stuff. But I'd love to hear from some of our listeners who have had to deal with that stuff.
Yeah, it's from what I've seen, I'm in the same situation as Chad, where I worked at studios that took care of that. Almost every studio is doing this legally. They're having the contract, they're writing this up, and they're saying, we're going to deliver these things on these days. And if, you know, if things are our fault or something happens with us, you obviously don't get charged more, but if you add more stuff to it, or, you know, you want the scope of work changes, then we're going to have to renegotiate this contract because this contract is now void because we're not doing what we said in this contract. We're doing something new, or we have to add on days or whatever. And all that's really spelled out. The thing to remember about contracts is they're only really good if things go bad. You know, if you do the work, I do the work and I pay you and everyone's happy, like, contracts are just kind of a formality at that point. And really the only thing a contract, speak to your lawyer, don't listen to me, but the only thing a contract protects is when things go bad. What a contract says is, if things go bad, what happens? And what it says is that it gives the rules on what happens when things go bad. It also gives the rules on what happens when things go right, but you usually don't have to like bring a lawyer to a courtroom for that. You know, from what I understand, emails do protect you in a certain amount of way where you can look back and say, look, we both agreed on it. You said yes to this email. We did this. But the overall feeling in the industry, as far as what I've been seeing, is moving more and more towards actual contracts, getting one set up, paying the money up front to do it. And honestly, there's so many more ways to get your own contract with your name and your letterhead and all this stuff on it that's official that doesn't cost as much. There's sites that do this, give you templates. You could ask a friend how they do it. Other freelancers share these things and try to, you know, get this stuff under control, because you could be sure that if you're dealing with an agency that they have contract and it's not going to be in your favor. So it is definitely one of those things to look up. There's a great talk about it called FU Pay Me that I'll link up. And it's a great talk about the contractual side of it. And I promise you that it's entertaining and not boring. It's very, very fun.
Well, it's got a swear word in it.
Got a swear word. Yeah. FU Pay Me. Great talk. I will link that up. And there's probably even more stuff since then. That's quite a few years since this talk, but it will get you thinking about contracts and all this stuff. But that is a really good way to set up expectations, is to just write it down. Here's what we're going to do. Here's what you're going to do. And
I mean, there's always going to be road bumps and there's always going to be issues and things like that. It's just being able to navigate them. And the ultimate goal is to create something where the client is happy and they come back and they give you more business. And that's really, that's something that is really obvious to people that run their own business, but not as obvious to those like myself and other people who worked in studios who never really, when you're in a studio, a client is a different thing. Like it's not somebody you have a relationship with the way you do if you're have your own business and work from home, or you have a small studio and you're the one, you know, going out there and hustling. So it's really, it's an interesting thing. I've known a lot of people that have gone from the studio to owning their own small shop. And it's a transition you have to make, because when you're at a studio and you're in a bullpen with six or seven other motion designers, 3D people, whatever, the client is like a foreign concept. It's like the person who the producer tells you about through an email. Maybe you saw them once at the kickoff, or we're on a conference call or something.
Yeah, but like 75% of the client is your manager or the creative director or the producer. Like that's your client. And sometimes it's just, you know, from the other end, it's just how much time do we have? That's what's really coming from on high.
Yeah, yeah, totally. And I think that's really, it's, I guess, a problem that the studios have, because if they could somehow communicate the mentality that the small business owner has about their client and how precious they are to their survival to the studio people working in the trenches, then I think they'd get a different, I think that people like even myself would actually have a bit more skin in the game. Because when you're in a studio and like you said, the orders are coming in from not, you know, maybe even a creative director, not even the client, you're not sure who you're making it for at that point.
Yeah, it's hard to have empathy for the client sometimes if they're just a person with a bunch of changes and that you don't understand what they're coming to you for and why you in particular, why the studio in particular. That having that empathy does help. It doesn't help like when there's a bad change or something that frustrates everybody, but it can help when you're like, all right, well, like they hired us to do this. We are in the service industry. We're here to serve them. And that they're also asking for our expertise, but it's their project. So I have a question. Maybe this is like a role play situation. I'm not sure. Have we done any role playing on the Grayscale Gorilla podcast?
I can't wait. That sounds good.
It's going to be fun. I want to know how you, Chad, would describe the 3D process, at least how you did it, to somebody that's not familiar with it. Because I think that's happening a lot in the industry. People want to obviously add more 3D. This has been happening for over 15 years. Add more 3D to their, you know, animation. They're coming to you, Chad, and they're like, we would love to get our logo flinging around and a bunch of type and a zoom in on a car. We're coming to you to do this stuff. And you start to describe to them what the process is. And I'm asking because I think there's a lot of artists out there that kind of assume that everybody knows how this works. And I know that I do this all the time. I just say, you know, like I go in and I make the car and then I'll send you a version of it. And all of a sudden they see a gray render with no textures and no reflections. And they're like, you're the worst at this. Like,
oh my God, what have we done?
And so you're like, wait. So how do you, you know, that's really about expectations.
I've dealt with that so many times, dude. I have three stories I can tell you and I'll make them fast. So I dealt with this a long time ago, an embarrassingly long time ago. And this was like, you know, before a lot of things made it easier to understand, like the internet. And so my boss was like, he saw this problem and he was like, yeah, clients just don't understand why this takes so long. We got to think about a way to explain it to them. So I literally had a character that I had made back then, and I printed out the character and all the different stages of working on it, from concept sketch to modeling to putting bones in it to rigging it to animating it. And I printed it all out, and in my office I hung them up on the wall, and I kind of like the evolution chart, you know, where it started
awesome.
With the fish or whatever and like ended with man walking upright. I did that and I wrote down each phase. And the goal was to when the producer, the director, whoever walked the clients through and they wanted to teach them about the process, there was like a visual aid right there where they could say, in the beginning, it looks like this and it goes to this and then it looks like that. And that was the first time I had to explain it. And obviously that only worked in a very sort of as things became more complicated, it became a lot more difficult to explain the process. And then I worked with this producer. She was amazing. She actually was probably one of my favorite producers I've ever worked with. And she came up with this metaphor of building a house that really like resonated with clients. Like it, and so it became our thing, where she, upon our first meetings with the client, would say, well, this process, just so you know, it's kind of like building a house. And at first, you know, when you are digging the foundation, it really doesn't look like anything. And you might put the studs up and it still looks like kind of crappy. And you're like, what is this going to be? But you know, someday it's going to be a beautiful house at the end. Well, that's what this process is like. And she was really good at explaining it to them in that way so that they could say, oh, okay. And then at each point in the process, when we'd show them a previs, she'd be like, okay, so this is kind of like we've just put up the drywall and it's not painted yet. So you're just seeing the rough outline of your house. And we need you to make decisions on where the counters are going to go and where the light fixtures are going to go. And that's the kind of decisions we need right now. Just real broad decisions. And because everybody's so into watching like home improvement shows like HGTV, you know, it's like so popular that everybody understands it. So I remember we did this like 30 second all CG spot for a client that had never done CG before, and it scared the hell out of them. And luckily enough, they were sort of local. So they came down to the office and we had a meeting with them, and the whole meeting was just us educating them on the process. And we had a slideshow. We showed them previous jobs, and we showed them what previs looks like from our previous job. We showed them what look dev frames look like and when those happen. And we talked about the curve, and like in the beginning, this job's going to go really slow and you're going to wonder what the hell these guys are doing. But that's because we have this person called a technical director who's writing a script that's going to make this part of the process easier. So at this part of the stage, it's going to be really slow. But that the work that that person is doing is going to speed us up when we get to the end. And as long as you're like kind of using that HGTV home improvement sort of metaphor, they feel like, oh, whew, okay, good. So it's not going to be gray and crappy. Okay, good, good. And yeah, that's kind of how I've done it in the past, and it worked for me. So
no, that's great. So you would walk them through that process, and if you were to do it today, would you use that metaphor and say, hey, it's a little bit like this? And I think you've said this too before. You're like, well, like building a house, if you want to make changes early on, it's a lot less time expensive than if you want to make changes after the paint's up.
Yeah, exactly. You nailed it. That's how this producer handled those things. Like, she was like that. I think that might have even been why she landed on that metaphor, because as anybody who's ever had construction done or redid a bathroom or a kitchen or even just watched a TV show, you know that if you have construction and you have to go back down to the studs to fix something, that's going to be really expensive. And that's kind of what she would do. She would, at the later parts of the process, if they're like, hey, you know what? We love it, but that model right there, we want to tweak the way that this thing looks on that model. She's like, okay, great. Yeah, we can totally do that. But just so you know, that's sort of like going back down to the foundation. So that means everything that we built on top of it, the drywall, the hardwood floors, the paint, the finish, would all have to be redone from that point. And we can totally do it, but here's what that's going to cost. And that, whenever she did that, it was like, you found out real quick how important that change was.
Right.
Because if it was important, then they're like, we don't care what it costs. That needs to be like this. Then we'd be like, cool, we're going to go do that. But if it was like the art director or someone who just thought, well, we think it looks cooler. And then as soon as like, you're like, we have to tear something like a metaphor like that, where like you say, well, you have to tear it down to the studs. Like that just sounds bad. And you're just like, oh God, let's not do that. And then you can explain to them, well, let me just explain to you what is a stud, like tearing down to the foundation changes, and what a just touch up some paint changes. Mm-hmm. Like you want to tweak the color? No problem. We can do that up until the last minute. You want to change the exposure on a shot, make it brighter, darker. That's something we can do up until the last minute. That's like changing a knob on a cabinet. But if you want to change the cabinets, that's going to cost you.
Right. Like at the final part of this house, we're going to walk through the house and take really nice photos. And that's the end part of the process. And it's then when we're trying not to move too much stuff, but we can like expose it or move the camera or whatever. Right. Like that's a nice metaphor.
It works. It works all the way back. I mean, you could go all the way back to the blueprints. It's really easy. We're on paper now. We're just scratching notes.
Yeah, that's okay. You're right. I forgot about that. She I think she actually used that as the boards, like when we would sometimes hire like a storyboard artist to come in and like draw the entire storyline out. And that's what we would say is like, this is kind of our blueprints. And that worked even on that level. It was good. I missed when she left, I was like, oh,
they understand.
So bummed.
Her metaphor lives on.
She was there when I got the scar on my head. She was she was sitting next to me when that happened.
Oh, see. And if you want, I forget. Did you tell that story at Half Rez, or did you just hint at that story?
No, you told it.
Oh, I told it. I think I showed even pictures of it when it happened. Right.
Yeah, you can go watch Chad's Half Rez talk from last year. No, this is good. I think that metaphor. You know, I love a good metaphor. That is helpful because. Describing how this works and making sure that people understand it, that's what expectations will help with, is so that when there is a problem or when there is a change, that you can do you could say yes, of course, and here's what it costs, because now they know that their changes later in the process are going to cost more, and changes right now are going to cost less. Like we're on paper, we're sketching, you want a door there, no problem. It's just the cost of a new door. You want a door there later, man, we might have to move some pipes and wires, and that is no good. I enjoy that. I'll write that one down. I'm going to remember the house metaphor. Maybe that's how I describe what the heck I do for a living.
Wait, you build houses? Wait, what?
Yeah, kind of.
Only it's not wires. It's models and stuff.
Build houses. I think that might work better at the bars in Michigan here when they're like, so what do you do for a living? I'm like, oh, I make software. They're like, oh, I'm going to go talk to this person over here.
Like what kind of software?
3D. Never mind. I'm going to tell them I make houses.
Yeah.
Really? Tell me all about it. What kind of pickup? And I'm like, well, let me tell you what kind of pickup. You ever heard of Turbo Squid?
I got all the models.
I got every Ford you could think of, man.
Oh, really? What model are you driving? I don't know. I got it from Turbo Squid. It's one of those.
I don't know. FBX.
Yeah. Or it's an OBJ. I can't remember.
You got a photo of it? Do I? Let me. Wow.
360.
Wow, that looks great. How did you do a 360 here? Oh, man.
Why is it on a Hot Wheels track?
Oh, man. Oh, man. That's fun. Thanks for the topic idea, Chad. I think that'll be helpful. And as always, you know, if you're listening, you have experience doing this, you're out there saying, oh, that's a great metaphor, I've also used this, put it in the comments. We're always trying to learn how everyone does this, and your comment alone will help someone else reading through these metaphors, these ways of thinking. Even just that book that you made or the prints that you made of like, hey, we're in this part of the process, and now we're in this part of the process. It's going to look more colorful here. It's going to look more gray here. It's going to look like, you know, outlines here. Even that alone is something that you, that early on in the project, you can go through your client with, or set up a site for them for, or a little booklet and say, here's the process and here's the way we're going to do this. But
somebody should make like an explainer video, like, welcome to 3D animation.
There's so much more behind the scenes now with like Pixar movies, and I guess every movie now it's all 3D, or every animated movie. I feel like there's so much more behind the scenes where a lot more people get it, and they feel like, oh, it's rigged, and it's another person textures it, another person lights it, and it's really complex. And I feel like that is there for sure, but a lot of that stuff can turn off as soon as there's deadline and money involved, where you're like, it still takes a really long time.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing that happens too is you'll have clients, I've run into this situation where something changes on their end, like their boss moves a date up, or maybe they have a media buy that they forgot about or something, and they need it like a lot faster than would ever be possible, and they have unlimited cash to spend, and they're just like, we don't care how much it costs, we'll give you whatever it takes to get this 2 weeks earlier. And I've seen those situations where it's like, you have to explain to them that it and the producer's like, oh, yay, you know, like we're gonna get all the anything we want, you know. And I'm just like, well, okay, so let's just really think about that for a second. Like, it doesn't necessarily matter how many more bodies we throw at this. It still won't work sometimes. I mean, sometimes more bodies do make it easier if it's like rotoing or whatever. But there's a lot of times where you just are limited by the output of a few people. And no matter how many, you can't slice that work up 10 different ways. And that's where it's like, even the house metaphor kind of helps there too, because you could say, well, we can't have 20 people cutting the same countertop out of granite. Like, that just, it's one thing. It needs to be cut by one person or one machine. And hopefully they kind of get that, but that has happened. It's very rare, but sometimes, you can make that work, and you can rent 20 machines for your render farm and get it done.
Yeah. Knowing what happens when it goes wrong, man, that's really the secret, right? Like, if everything goes right, both sides, everyone's happy, you could do those jobs all day. But as soon as there's a change, I shouldn't even say wrong. As soon as there's a change, maybe they need the model to change because the model changed. Maybe the design of the car literally changed for safety reasons. They need you to update it. Well, right. Then they have to do that update. That's not a decision they can make later. But
I think that's why you have to, as an artist, you need to start designing your work in a way that can be easily tweaked up until the last minute, as much as you can. Like, there's some things that you just can't. You got to like lock down.
Well, yeah, there's always that point where it's like, well, we've gone as far as we can. It has to get baked at this point. It's like, dang it. You had to make it editable. And now we're stuck with that. But make sure you save a different scene file at that time and be able to jump back to that step. But anything you can do non-destructively.
Exactly.
Whatever that means. Like the ability to have instances or place things via a cloner until, okay, it's time to send a render farm. Maybe we bake it down, make it editable. But up until that point, I can swap that model for any other model, and it's super easy. Or we have to go manually change them out one by one.
Oh. Well, this is why I constantly like preach about compositing and learning the importance of every 3D artist to learn compositing, because so much can be fixed in the composite. So much can be done. So much can be tweaked. If you, if something goes wrong in a render, and it's only happening on 4 frames, just go paint it out. Don't re-render. Just go into the comp and paint out that problem area, or fix it, do a patch.
Yeah, see, but no, here's where I get stuck. The very thing you're describing is a reason to do that. And I think compositing, absolutely, you have to do it. But you say, go ahead and just paint out those 4 frames. And they go, oh, wait, we're tweaking the camera over a little bit. And now you have those 4 frames to paint out again. And then again, and again, and again.
Yep.
So at that point, that is a baked down thing that has to be redone every time if any change comes in that happens at an earlier level. Like if it's more foundational change, all that compositing work is gone.
Yeah, that's not something that I recommend doing if the job still has 2 more weeks going in it. That's the kind of thing you do in the last 5 hours where you're like, yes. Oh my God, look, there's a problem right there. That right, happened.
These are an hour a frame, and we're waiting on a deadline, and we're waiting on somebody's here to like get the tapes over to so and so. And
but what I would do is if we had that situation and we like it went to the editor, and the editor's like, hey, there's a problem right here, there's like some sort of popping edge right here, and we had to deliver something that day, we just go paint it out. And then while that's being painted out, I would have the artist who made it go back and kick off the render with the fix. That render with the fix wouldn't be going to client that night, but it would be done if we needed it to be. And I always did that. Like any sort of like, I never left a patch a patch. I always, if the patch had to deliver to get the job out, great. But that patch was going to be fixed for the archive so that going back in, no one would have to remember, hey, didn't we do a patch fix over this like chattering texture right here? Because that will mess you up and mess people up for years to come.
Yep. When they come back for the multilingual version, man, that's really that's really when all the little patches start flying out.
Dude, like, why does multilingual versions? I forgot about all those.
why doesn't this look like this? Like, remember we had to go hand rotoscope out all those frames? Well, dude, that problem is back to bite us now for different languages. In different languages.
That happens every single day. Someone out there right now is dealing with that.
Someone out there is rotoing. Because they don't have time. And really, thanks for listening to the Grayscale Girl podcast. It means a lot to us that you're taking this very stressful time, spending it with us. Means a lot. Means a lot to me. I know it means a lot to Chad and Chris. We're rounding out into an hour here, so we should wrap this one up. And we're always looking at you. We consider this a conversation not just between the three of us, but other people in the industry that are either doing this, have solutions. You know, Grayscale Gorilla at the core of it is a community. That's the goal here, is to be around people that do this for a living, that want to help each other and learn faster. And so if you have a way to talk to a client or a little trick like we've been talking about, put it in the comments. I know we read them all, and I'm sure our viewers love seeing helpful comments down there. And if you're listening to this on the podcast, please leave us a review. That's always a big help for iTunes. It helps us get the word out and helps more designers and 3D artists discover us, rambling on about metaphors and helping clients. So if you like the show, I appreciate it. Thanks for the likes. Thanks for the comments. Thanks for the questions. And we also get questions and topic ideas from artists just like you, just like we did today. So I really appreciate it. And if there's nothing else, I'd like to thank you once again for listening to the Grayscale Gorilla podcast. And we'll see you in another episode really soon. Goodbye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye, guys.